Capercasters, it's Jim Brown again with another issue of the Outrig Capercast. And I'm wondering how many of you folks have read my book, the one called Among the Multihulls. I expect many of you have, and hope you enjoyed it, and I appreciate very much your buying the book if that's how you got a hold of it. But did you know that I've written an afterword for that book? Yeah, I went in there chapter by chapter, included a little synopsis of each chapter, just a few lines. It'll save you from reading or buying the book if you want to get it that way. And then I wrote some comments, sort of updates to the chapters to indicate what had been happening with regard to that chapter since it was published. Now, to cover all the chapters in both volumes, that afterword business runs about 25 pages. And for those of you who choose to listen to this stuff instead of read it, I'm going to try to do an audio of the afterword. And then some. I'll add comments about things that have happened since the afterword was published about 2 years ago. Now, it's posted on OutrigMedia.com as a text document, and it's there for you to read. It's called The Next Last Chapter. But now I'm going to offer here a series of audio afterwards, one for each chapter. It's for you folks who would rather listen to this stuff than read it, and there'll be a lot more info here than in the text document. And we'll call this series The Last Next Chapter. Now, I should tell you that my relationship with Christy has improved somewhat just recently. We had one of those late night no BS skull sessions and came out onto a plateau and agreed to be nice to each other. Otherwise, we were going to have to split the blanket, you know. So I'll ask Christy to read the abstracts to you. And then I'll chime in with trying to let you know by remarks just what's been going on since the book was published. And with any luck, you know, if I can keep from talking too much, we'll be able to get in more than one chapter for each podcast. Now, the original working title for my book was to be called Wind Against Current. It was to indicate the winds of change blowing against the inexorable drift of current of tradition. But because the book was to be distributed mainly on the web, Joe Farinaccio figured it really ought to have the word multihull in its title, so that it could be found by the search engines. And that made sense, and so we called it Among the Multihulls. Sort of short for My Life Among the Multihulls. Now, things have improved since then. We've discovered that wind actually causes current. And so the drift has changed now, and multihulls are going along with it on somewhat smoother seas than when the movement started out post-war. And I, for one, am going to find it interesting to explore that good old story Among the Multihulls with the aim of adding material to bring it up to date. We just may find that we can reach some heretofore rather ethereal conclusions. Let's see what happens. So here's Christy to read for you just the abstract of Chapter 1.
Chapter 1, To Build a Baby. The Freudian meaning of boats. Drawing the plans, starting scrimshaw, planking parties. Multihull events of late 60s. Writing construction manual, launching scrimshaw, collision with Commodore, ramming restaurant, Bacchanal wins Transpac, friends take over author's blooming design business, Browns take off for Panama in scrimshaw, a family crew with no destination and no plans to return to California.
Yes, the Freudian meaning of boats. And you remember how the first chapter opens up? I'm hanging around a campfire with my old buddy Walt Glazer, and the flames are popping, the ashes are getting into our wine, and we're talking about, you know, why a man builds a boat. And Walter says, a man doesn't build a boat to stay out of the bars. A man builds a boat to make up for the fact that he can't build a baby. Well, we've been through all of that more than once with these capers, but for those who haven't heard them all, I suppose it's fair to summarize by saying that we really believe that one reason that sailing is such a guy thing is that women don't need that particular outlet for creativity, the most nearly alive thing that a guy can produce with his own hands, the most responsive to its local environment, and yet at the same time the most compliant with the wishes of her custodian. And I began to really appreciate what Walter would have called the subliminal aspects of motivation for we who decide to mess about in multi-hulls. And it was Walter who got me thinking on that subliminal level. Walter did a bit of designing of multi-hulls, a line of trimarans, I think two or three models, that he called Sally Lightfoot, the only trimaran that stumbles through the water. But Walter's boats did more than stumble. Boy, he built an early Piver 35 with some modifications, including a nice big deep centerboard, and sailed it to Hawaii and back with his buddy Dick Homestead. And I had worked with Homestead before when we were building big fiberglass monohulls, and Dick was a very traditional New England sailor. And when Dick came back from that round trip to Hawaii and back with Walter, he said to me one day, he said, "You know, Jim, trimarans will really do it. I see what you're up to now. All you got to do is put a big board in them, and they'll really do it." I guess he and Walter had had quite a thrash getting back from Hawaii when approaching the American coast. That's a difficult sail. You have to go way north and come in maybe up there by Seattle and work your way down. They tried to cut across and they had a lot of thrashing to windward to do. And it really proved in Dick's mind and in Walter's mind that a good cruising trimaran could definitely beat against the wind. Now, this was well after Joanna and I had made our trip south in the little 24-foot Piver, Juana, and by the mid-1960s, I was very much involved in designing my own boats. It was pre-Sea Runner time, but we did the Manta and the off-soundings, and neither one of those boats had centerboards. They had large fixed fins in the floats. And it was not a bad compromise. Those boats were okay to windward for being cruising boats, at least when the wind blew. They were not sharp in light airs. And in some circumstances, those fixed fins in the floats proved to be quite vulnerable. Remember, we knocked one off when launching Mark Hassel's 38-foot off-soundings down there off of Santa Barbara. So when I dreamed up the Sea Runner series, whose main distinctions, of course, were the central cockpit and the stern castle and the cutter rig, when I dreamed that whole thing up, it was centered around a centerboard. It had to have a great big trunk in the middle of the boat in order to be a real seagoing sailboat. And that centerboard trunk took up so much room in the middle of the boat that, I just pretty much had to put the cockpit on top of it. Central cockpit. Mast stepped in the cockpit. All of that came out of the thinking and the experience that we had, up into the middle 1960s. Now, to my knowledge, no one else has used that particular configuration in a trimaran. I think it was such a distinctive hallmark of my stuff that nobody else cared to step in. I mean, it really was pretty bizarre. Mast stepped in the cockpit, so you didn't have to leave the cockpit to operate the controls at the mast. It was pretty straightforward. It has been used in catamarans. For instance, some of the Morelli and Melvin gunboat catamarans, they have the helm in the pilot house directly behind the open cockpit, and directly in front of the open cockpit is the mast. So we still have that ability in those boats to operate without going on deck. And of course, the same thing is true in the Chris White Atlantic type catamarans. They have a similar arrangement, a big pilot house just aft of the open portion of the cockpit, and the that open cockpit area is fronted by the mast step, and Chris puts the helm either at the mast step or in the pilot house or both. Now, some, but not all, of those central cockpit catamaran designs have either dagger boards in the hulls or fixed mini-keels on the hulls. And in some cases, like the Chris White boats, there is a swing centerboard mounted in the mini-keel. And that's the best of both worlds, because the mini-keel increases the draft of the main hull sufficient to make the rudder not the deepest place. And all that stuff doesn't matter a whit to the racers, but those who are going cruising will soon learn that the rudder better be a kick-up rudder or not the deepest place in the boat. Why? Because damage to the rudder leaves the boat more incapacitated than a dismasting. One good thing about catamarans is that they've got two rudders, and you're unlikely to bust them both. And now, of course, in the hydrofoiling boats, the lateral resistance, that is the dagger board's function to prevent the boat from sliding sideways, is incorporated in the hydrofoils themselves. And for me, that whole string of logic about lateral resistance started out with my experience with the Piver Frolic, the little 16-footer, which had a serious dagger board, and the Piver Nugget, the 24-footer, our Wana, which had a really serious dagger board. Great, big, deep sucker. But by the time Walt Glaser built his first Piver 35-foot Lodestar and made his trip to Hawaii, by then, Piver had taken the centerboards out of all of his designs. He figured they were too much work and too much nuisance. And it's true, boy, either a dagger board or especially a swing centerboard is a real pain in the neck. It can give you fits at times, making the controls work properly and the water slopping around in the trunk and splashing up out of the trunk and so on. But you really get something for that dagger board, something much more than just the ability to go to windward. You get maneuverability. It's unparalleled by the boats that just have shallow mini-keels or fixed fins in the floats. Hey, that reminds me of a story. When Joanna and I were headed down the coast there, we had Dick York aboard with us above Point Conception when we were going down the coast in 1959, this would have been. Something happened. I think we ran over a big wad of kelp, and my dagger board, in which the top of the trunk emerged in the main cabin, when that thing was in the full down position, we didn't have any splashing trouble at all, but the wad of kelp had sort of cocked the board diagonally aft in the trunk, and all of a sudden we had a fountain of water pouring into the boat out of the top of the trunk. I thought we had a big leak. I was scared. But we put the boat up into the wind to slow her speed. She had been going very fast at the time. And we put her up to stall her and discovered that the board was askew in the trunk. And we got it back down again and asked Joanna to sit on it until we got into shelter that night. Years later, I had the same thing happen with our 27-foot, very racy trimaran called Caravelle. I was preparing to take her out and was approached on the dock by an older man with a young girl, and he explained that this was his granddaughter and he would really like to give her the experience of going sailing. Could they go along? And I said, okay. So off we went. I don't know, we were a couple of miles outside Santa Cruz, California, when we hit a floating railroad tie. And again, the boat was going very fast. It knocked the dagger board askew, and again, the top of the trunk was in the main cabin. And I was on the helm when I heard water pouring in. I thought, oh, man. Well, we got inside the wind line, dropped the jib, and discovered that there was no puncture in the main hull at all. It was just water pouring in over the top of the centerboard trunk. But I had a serious emotional problem on my hands. This old man was frantic with concern for his granddaughter. The girl didn't care, but the poor old guy didn't understand that the boat could not sink. And these two experiences made it plain to me that a daggerboard trunk should go all the way up through the deck, either through the cabin top or through the deck of the main of the outer hull in a catamaran, so that there was no possibility of having water pour in over the top of the trunk into the boat. Well, getting back to Walter, probably it was in the late 60s, he inherited big money. He sort of went off the deep end, began blowing a lot of it on hedonism. He had been married and had two children, one of them with special needs. So his ex-wife and his brother went after Walter in court and managed to divest him of almost all of his inheritance on the premise that the boy with special needs was going to need that money. And maybe they were right. They succeeded in court and left Walt destitute for the rest of his life. He had barely enough money to live on, only by living aboard of his boat in the Santa Cruz Harbor, where he stayed right up past the millennium. He had suffered polio as a kid. Now it was coming back. He couldn't really work. He became embittered and very cynical. But his cynicism was mixed with humor to the point where the two of them were very strong. And he became known as the gut-splitting bard of Santa Cruz Harbor. He finally became enfeebled, was a ward of the state in hospital. The harbor had to haul out his boat and cut it into pieces and take it to the dump. It could not be sold because Walter's pet rat had chewed the place up so much inside that nobody would consider living in it. And Walter became so angered by life that nobody could be with him much. And when he finally died, I guess I was one of the few who really missed him. I still miss him. I learned a lot from him. I have what remains of his design work and his writings, some of which are truly inspired. I have all of that stuff in my collection for the Mariners Museum, and it's that kind of material that we would really like to scan and publish online as part of the Outrig project. And I mention Walter here because he is just one example of so many men who undertook to participate in the successive refinements of the modern multi-hull. People who invested substantial portions of their lives in bringing this thing about. But Walter's influence on me was that he got me to thinking about this, these so-called subliminal properties that entice us into this endeavor. And in the years since, my own thinking about, you know, building a boat to make up for the fact that you can't build a baby, all the way to the point where I think a lot of yacht ownership is explained by what I call the last-ditch stand phenomenon, wherein a guy, and sometimes a gal, wants to have an implement with which to escape from the potential for cataclysms ashore, be able to mobilize oneself to steer around geopolitical hotspots. I just don't see any other explanation for why there are so many idle, big, beautiful yachts, cruising yachts, sitting around so seldom used. They are a testament to wasted wealth on one hand, but also to that feeling of security, if there is such a thing, that one gets by having a serious ocean cruising sailboat ready to go. Of course, there's a great gulf in there between being ready to go and being able to go. There's so much to learn and practice to become a person comfortable at sea. And that happens only after you somehow manage to get your life's affairs in order so that you can just leave the harbor. Personally, I always found it a great comfort to feel that I was able to go, at least on a subliminal level, as Walter would say. And nowadays, of course, I've added another level to the sublime by hypothesizing that humankind is going to definitely need this technology that has been evolving over the past 50 or 60 years. I feel that there's no doubt that in another 50 or 60, or in another 150 or 60, that lightweight seafaring vessels of all sizes are definitely going to figure into the survival of the human species. Now, of course, nobody really knows what's going to happen, but things are moving pretty fast. Our environment is changing, not just our natural environment, but also our social, economic, and pandemic environment is changing. And as it goes with all species, they go extinct when they fail to respond to changes in their environment, nowadays the global environment. And today I think of multi-hulls as just an example of the kind of technologies that humans are now advancing by successive refinements that really amount to nothing more than the application of modern technology to ancient concepts. So I've seen it progress from the adventure and travel motives of the 1950s on up through the escape and paranoia of the 1960s and into the rabid competitiveness of multi-hull ocean racing in the 1970s, 80s, 90s. And there's a dichotomy there. You know, the racers, the money spent on racing has had a lot to do with the advancement of modern multi-hull and lightweight technology. And yet there seems to be very little going on in the racer's subliminal motivation that relates to the background or the projected future of this classic case of reinvention, the modern multi-hull. So now, with the coming of wing sails and hydrofoils, it would seem that everything we've done has been in the interest of greed for speed. I disagree. I think that on a very subliminal level, we are interested in performance in order to achieve an implement of aquatic transportation that would be of real use during what I'm calling da-da-da-da-da, the Great Green Recovery. Well, hoo-wee, that's enough for Chapter 1. Christy has been literally biting her tongue. But she wants me to tell you that we have yet another way by which listeners can contribute to the Outrigged Project if they want. We now have a PayPal, one-time donor gift arrangement on the home page for the podcast. And thank you for those of you who are already using it. We also have a Patreon page for anyone who would like to kick in a few bucks per month regularly. And then I'm hoping to hear directly from anyone who would like to help us in a sustaining way to get this video trailer, or I'm calling it a tractor, available. It is happening. Danny Mydlack is working on it, but before he finishes, we're facing some rather daunting expenses impending. So now, anyone willing to help us out at least $100 per donation, I hope to hear from you by your calling my silly little track phone. It's 804-384-7022. I don't normally answer that phone, but I will call you back. Because I need your name and contact, we want to put you on the credits screen of our video trailer. And last but not least, I must inform you of the recent death of the great Ian Farrier. He's the guy who initiated the Corsair line of folding trimarans, trailerable trimarans, even up to and above 40 feet. Boats that would not only fold up for trailering or storage in the boatyard, but also could really get around the race course. Fast, powerful, overpowered vessels, in my opinion. But they had a lot to do with driving multi-hull racing in the last 20 years or so. I've always been very pleased with the fact that Ian Farrier, like Roger Hatfield and Chris White and John Marples, they all started out in boats that I designed, and they all figured they could do better, and they have. I never really got to know Ian. We did spend a couple of days together at Ibex many years ago, did a joint presentation on modern multi-hulls. The speaker before us was Peter Johnstone, who developed the incredibly successful J-Boat series of racing monohulls and went on to do the gunboat catamarans. The thrust of Peter Johnstone's presentation that in order to succeed in the boat production business, one had to do a lot of market research. And Ian remarked that might be true with monohulls, but it certainly was not true with multihulls, because in order to advance the type, he had to design what he thought the boating public was going to want, not what they already wanted. That the way to expand the boating marketplace was to offer something that was not there already. And of course he was right. Ian deserves a lot of credit for introducing the really, truly foldable, trailerable multi-hull. It's found its way into many other boats too, of course, including our Sea Clipper series and the Wind Riders and many others. So, fair winds to you, Ian, wherever you may now be sailing. Bye-bye.